Welcome to The Wrap-Up, a weekly podcast that gives you an insider's look at the top stories in Hollywood. I'm your host, Sharon Waxman, founder and editor-in-chief of The Wrap. Joining me is my co-host, Daniel Goldblatt, our assistant managing editor. Hey, Daniel.
Hey, I feel like this episode is kind of like a dream episode for us. We each had someone we really wanted to interview, and we each got them. It's fantastic.
I know. You guys are in for a treat. This week, we have a pair of great interviews with stars from HBO. First, we have my sit-down with Julianne Nicholson from Mare of Easttown. She plays Lori, Mare's best friend, and she turns out to be a key character in the plot. We talked about how she got involved with the project and why she never watches her own performances.
And I got the chance to speak with Uzo Aduba, the star of The Fantastic in Treatment. We discussed how the pandemic kind of actually helped her prepare for the part and how she thinks the show fits into the discourse around mental health. But before we get into all that, for your consideration for Outstanding Limited Series and all other categories, it's the HBO original limited series, The Undoing, starring Nicole Kidman and Hugh Grant. The series focuses on Kidman's Grace Fraser, a successful therapist, and her devoted husband, Jonathan, played by Grant, and their young son who attends an elite private school in New York City. A chasm opens in Grace's seemingly perfect life, a violent death, a missing spouse, and a chain of terrible revelations. All episodes of The Undoing are streaming now on HBO Max. With that out of the way, Sharon, let's get into some headlines. So by the time most of you listen to this podcast, the final episode of Conan O'Brien's late night show on TBS will have aired. He's headed over to HBO Max to do some kind of weekly series. We still don't have much in the way of details on that. Conan's late night legacy, it's an interesting one. He was plucked out of near obscurity to host Late Night in 1993, taking over for David Letterman. And then, of course, there's his awkward, shall we say, 7 months stint as host of The Tonight Show. Conan is leaving his
TV. Do you even remember that? My God, so long ago.
I know, but still awkward. Conan's leaving this TV show at a time when his ratings are quite terrible, and he goes out as one of the few late-night figures who stayed almost completely away from politics. By the way, those last 2 points, we went in deep on over at Rap Pro. I suggest you check it out. Really interesting stuff. Sharon, Conan has been on the air for 28 years. How are you going to remember his late-night tenure?
Well, it's interesting because Conan kind of grew on me personally. I sort of thought of him in the beginning as this really kind of dumb frat boy who got on TV because late night comic writers' rooms are kind of frat boy atmospheres. That's all sort of Harvard Lampoon crowd. And I didn't really think his stuff was funny. And the people who did seem to find it funny seemed to be young guys. But he really grew on me over time, and I thought that his humor it was very subtle and very kind of tongue-in-cheek and not and different from what other people were doing. But I do think that the double whammy of him being on TBS, which who can even find TBS on their cable dial and who even has cable anymore, just took him out of the conversation. The fact that he decided not to do political humor in the last 4 years that made people like Stephen Colbert a must watch, that hurt Jimmy Fallon, who also was not so comfortable with political humor, or that made Trevor Noah more of a must watch. Both of those guys got slow starts when they got the slots that they were in, both Stephen Colbert on CBS and Trevor Noah. But Conan was just out of the conversation. So I think there's a moment that's really his moment, which is the 90s, pretty much. It's kind of too bad because he's still potentially at the height of his comic powers, but he doesn't really comment on things that feel like they penetrate much. What do you think?
Yeah, he just kind of goes about his business. And, you know, I think to your point, the average person might not even remember that he's still on TBS. I don't think the average person would have noticed in the last couple of years his show went from an hour to half an hour. And now he's going to HBO Max. He has kind of lived these last few years kind of anonymously. And he doesn't really have a thing that I could really
point to
as like, that's where Conan. I know. It just, yeah. But he's good.
It might be Daniel, that HBO Max is good for him, that he can find his super users, his super audience, and go niche and really work on that and maybe find something that is really distinctive to him that a certain narrow audience really is devoted to.
Yeah. And I think to the point you made about Colbert and Noah, I'd throw Seth Meyers into that group.
He
just decided to go super political, got rid of he used to like come out and do a monologue. He does the whole thing now from like behind the desk, and he sort of found his rhythm the more he leaned in that direction.
I mean, you could also argue that just sort of the advent of Jon Stewart, which is quite a long time ago, Jon Stewart's been on and off the air in the time that since Conan started, but that Jon Stewart changed the nature of late night and that it needed to go political in order to be relevant. It's not that the more sort of the broadcast late night hosts still had audiences. But, you know, if you were going to be off of broadcast television where you're just sort of easy to find on the dial, you really, really needed to have a way in and a brand and something distinctive. And Jon Stewart made that political humor.
I have a strange admission.
You never watched Jon Stewart?
No, my favorite late night host was Craig Kilborn.
Okay.
I don't understand it. Now I look back on it, I'm like, wow, that was weird. Because he hasn't done a thing since. But I loved Kilborn.
When he spoke? That's interesting.
Yeah, I watched him every night. I don't know why now. I mean, I still look back at some of the bits and laugh, but like, it's such a weird thing that was the one that I sort of gravitated towards.
That's interesting.
I have no reason for it.
All right. Well, farewell, Conan, and best and Godspeed.
Godspeed.
Right. So all eyes, but mostly ears, were on the Los Angeles Superior Court on Wednesday, where Britney Spears called in to give her first public comments about her conservatorship. And the pop star made it very, very clear that she wants it all to end. She called the conservatorship abusive. She likened it to sex trafficking. And she said, quote, "I'm not happy. I can't sleep. I'm so angry. It's insane. I'm depressed and I cry every day." Daniel, feels like the public in general and the entire entertainment industry is very much behind Britney Spears. We ran a story yesterday about the reactions that we were seeing, and they were very much shocked and on her behalf, including people like Justin Timberlake came out on her behalf. Yeah. You've covered Britney for years. What is your take on this?
It's interesting. My wife and I were talking about this last night, and it's weirdly the kind of topic where you can't, I don't want to evoke cancel culture because that's super weird, but like everyone is so pro Britney that if you introduce anything that's, I don't want to say anti, but on the other side of
here's
things,
your chance. I'm laying out the floor. Come
so
on,
Britney
tell it like it is.
So Britney is not a well person. If you read the transcripts, because it was sealed, so you can't listen into clips. You can find it on the rap.
We have the transcript on the site.
She just rambles on and on. She's on medication. It's been reported she's bipolar. The last time it was reported about her custody agreement, she only has 30% visitation of her children. So that should tell you something about what the courts think about her. She's someone who needed help. I think the conservatorship was a needed thing. Is it still needed? I think she's old enough now to be like, if you want to go and do stuff, and if it turns out to be bad, fine. She's old enough now maybe to get that choice. But the idea that the conservatorship was all terrible is, in my opinion, completely false. She needed this. This had to happen, but maybe it's just sort of worn out its welcome, and she deserves the right to figure it out on her own from here.
Well, it's pretty interesting because I definitely think that perspective that you have, which is based on having really been up close with her for many years as an observer, is very much the outlier point of view. Right now, you're right. The media tsunami, because it's always a tsunami, was like everywhere. CNN was like the lead story. NBC everywhere is this is a terrible thing. But I think speaking just as a regular person, and hearing her speak as a regular person, is that it's so oppressive. It really does take away all of her individual rights, like the right of self-determination. There are ways to deal with people who are mentally troubled and emotionally troubled without taking away all their rights to self-determination while that person is out there performing and making millions of dollars for other people and money she can't spend. So I think it's just kind of the draconian nature of what this measure was. And maybe there was a small window of time where that was necessary, that she was a danger and a risk of harm to herself and others. That really needs to be the bar. Are you a risk of harm to others, first of all, and then to yourself? And if she's, and that really should be like a short window. The stuff that I'm reading about is really pretty shocking. I saw her nanosecond attorney, Adam Streisand, on the cable news networks last night, who's a local attorney who I happen to know. He was also in the Britney documentary. The idea that she has a court appointment, she's a multi-million dollar, a year performer, at least, and she has a court-appointed attorney that she can't choose her own attorney who can advocate aggressively and zealously on her behalf, which is the job of an attorney. That seems really messed up. I don't see how. And then also, you got to say kind of poor thing when she says yesterday in court, I didn't realize that I had the right to ask to end my conservatorship. It's like, okay, one, really? So maybe that attorney should be disbarred for not actually asking his client, how do you feel about this conservatorship, Brittany? Because the Free Brittany movement has been, you could hardly miss it. So I think, your perspective to me is super valuable, because those of us who read the transcript and didn't hear her speaking missed the fact that apparently she sounded a little off.
The judge said twice, you need to slow down.
But slowing down does not say you sound like a wackadoodle. Slowing down means you're talking fast.
Yeah, and manic. Like I trying to edit transcript and trying to put grammar and punctuation to it was fun. The one thing I'll just point out real quick, just for people who don't know how conservatorships work, there are two, I think, different kinds. There's a personal conservatorship, which is something that would govern or take ownership over medical decisions and life decisions and things like that. And then a financial one, which controls your business. She has both. So that's where maybe there's some room to.
By the way, I didn't know that. So thank you for elucidating that. But that really seems like, even if you'd have, the personal one seems particularly like.
That's the one. I mean, she talked about both, right? Because she talked about being able to just go where she wants to go and do what she wants to do and make decisions about her medical health that she can't. She legally has someone who does these things for her because it was deemed that she's incapable of it. She's probably evolved to, I think she's earned the right to fail if that's how it works out, because, she's.
Isn't there a middle ground where you can give somebody support, you can give somebody check-ins, but still not say you have to have an IUD inserted into your body against your will in case you get pregnant? That's like, what?
I don't think the IUD was inserted against her will, but she needs permission to get it out because it's a medical procedure, and the personal conservatorship.
Well, that is the grounds. That is about one kind of the same less offensive.
Yeah, only a little. But yes, that I think that's where that comes into play. I don't think she was forced to get it, but she just can't get it removed on her own because of she doesn't. She
yeah, well, that makes sense because I don't know how you would have a procedure like that done without your consent. But
yeah, that would be
unless terrible. You were unconscious, which would really be. Completely illegal in every way. And I'm not a lawyer, so I don't actually know if it is illegal, but it ought to be. Okay. All right.
Moving on. Every year, The Wrap hosts a conference called The Grill, which focuses on the convergence between entertainment, media, and technology. This week, we hosted a grill focused on the world of streaming. Pretty important. There were discussions on content acquisition and the content marketplace. And Sharon, you spoke with FilmRise CEO Danny Fisher about what his company is doing to gain a better understanding of what is happening in the market post-COVID and where the future of streaming is headed. Sharon, what were your biggest takeaways from this event?
Yeah, my takeaways were just that, we don't talk very much about the broad array of streaming companies that are out there. We tend to talk a lot about the very big companies, Netflix that almost everybody subscribes to, or Disney Plus, or HBO Max or whatever it may be. But there's actually a very healthy, next tier down ecosystem of niche streaming companies, and Filmrise is one of them. There's niche streaming around. There's one that that I'm aware of that has found its place, because a lot of the streaming companies were like testing different kinds of content and seeing what would work for them. One that literally thrives on Scandinavian murder mysteries. Not joking. And there's anime ones, there's horror ones. Sure. So there's a very thriving, you know, as I say, set of smaller niche companies that have found audiences and found healthy subscriber bases. In this case, this does not, Filmrise doesn't need a subscriber base because it's advertising supported. So you can watch it for free, like television. It's an over the top channel. And, you know, they have an algorithm where you can go at, where they figured out how to, know whether there's going to be a significant audience for the content that they're thinking about licensing. So in one case, it was like a 40-year-old Western black and white television show. Was it called The Marksman, it's something like that. And it's like way before my time, when that, even old as I am, where that show was popular, but it's worked. And it might be finding more obscure foreign titles, or even Canadian, which is technically foreign titles, that audiences have not yet discovered and would like to see. So that really is a very interesting takeaway, that there's not just, you know, we focus on the biggest companies and that are actually subscriber supported, where there's another whole tier of companies that are doing really well. And some of those are advertising supported. And so you hear about them less because they're kind of the less sizzly companies. So it's interesting.
Yeah, it's crazy to me how big some of those companies are, because sometimes me personally, I look at some of the things they offer and I'm like, who's watching this? And then I read an article, they have 10 million subscribers. And I'm like, whoa.
Yeah. He says they've got 10 million a month, I think is what Danny said. Yeah.
And it's just, it's crazy how, it just shows you how big this whole entire thing is when the companies you've never even heard of are pulling in that kind of numbers. I think it's just, for me, it's very interesting how things are just getting so fragmented into individual segments that you have to subscribe to all these things. I wonder if we're going to get, and a lot of them are bundling together, and it seems like we've debundled from cable and now we're sort of rebundling again slowly but surely.
1,000% are. You're going to see that. We should have Tim Basinger on from our pro team to talk about that. There, it's 1,000% what's happening, because it's nobody wants to subscribe to 20 different streaming services or even 10. And it gets to be pricey for people too. Plus they have to subscribe to Wrap Pro too. So, you know,
it adds up. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No. And then every streaming box you own is trying to push their own stuff on you as well. So you can't even find, I used to think Roku was great because it was very content agnostic. You could just have your channels, but now they have their own channel. So they're pushing their stuff at you. If you have a Prime, if you have a Amazon Prime box, they're pushing Amazon Prime Video stuff on you.
Yeah.
It's just like, you know, Apple TV, you load up, you're going to get all their stuff first. It's crazy.
It's more than that for me. For me, it's like, oh, I heard about this show. Where can I find it? And then I have to go on a hunt and peck mission to go figure out, is it on Amazon? Is it on this? Is it like, where can I find? Is it on Hulu? Oh, it's on Hulu. Now I got to start to subscribe to Hulu. And so that there's that frustration from on the consumer side. I'd love to hear if our listeners out there want to just at me on Twitter. I'm at Sharon Waxman. I'd be curious to hear what that experience is like for you, because I do think that it's a problem that's going to need solving.
Yeah, I find myself constantly like, do I want to subscribe to Paramount Plus for two shows that I kind of want to see?
I've been wanting to see Girl 5 Eva. I don't subscribe to Peacock. And
I canceled my Peacock today.
And you what?
Actually, I canceled my Peacock today because I had a free like 3-month thing, and I set a reminder in my calendar because I don't really watch anything on it.
Yeah, and I need to see it, and I will see it, but it's just like, okay. Okay, one more.
I know, there's so many.
Yeah.
All right. Check it out on therap.com. I highly recommend all those discussions. All right. As always, we like to conclude this first segment with a little something we call Wax On, Wax Off, where we allow our founder and editor-in-chief, Sharon Waxman, the opportunity to speak out about something she is particularly into this week, her Wax On, and something she's riled up about, upset about, fired up, angry. Maybe it's her text message sounds.
Exactly.
Sharon, as always, the floor is yours.
Thank you. All right. This week's Wax On is we should give a tip of the hat to our Congress. Why? Because we have just learned that a bipartisan group of members of Congress, including Senator Mitt Romney and others, have come up with a bipartisan deal. The word is just like, it is sounds familiar, but I don't know really what it means. Can you say it again? Bipartisan. Sounds good. To help fix the infrastructure of this country, which is really what our one of the things our tax dollars ought to do, fix the roads, make sure the bridges don't fall down, make sure we have airports, make sure there are train stations, you know, stuff like that. So both sides made big compromises. Apparently, Joe Biden gets another win after the right to vote legislation failed to even get the right to be debated in the Senate this week, which should be my wax off, but it's not. Let's hope this is a first step in the direction of finding a way for both parties to work together on behalf of the American people. That's us. That's the voters. That's the taxpayers. That's the rap listeners. You know, that's us. That's who they're supposed to be working for. So bravo to them. My wax off is, you know, I'm not the biggest fan, have never been over time of Britney Spears, but I think so many of us who are being forced to, you know, watch because it's everywhere in media, what is going on with her, can't help but just feeling compassionate toward this woman. And when, you know, when I go back and I looked at the clips from the interviews that she did with Matt Lauer at the time, and when the Britney documentary that the New York Times put out was out and everybody was talking how terrible Matt Lauer was, I didn't think Matt Lauer was terrible at all. I mean, she was clearly, you know, she like her boobs were spilling out of her shirt in that interview. There's video of her with her baby on her lap while she's driving an SUV. It's maybe a TMZ video. And it's like, okay, that does not really look like a person who's acting terribly responsibly, whether I like her music or don't like her music, but she's a public figure. And so challenging her seems like an acceptable thing to do. But where we are today, and when you hear what she's had to endure and having essentially her personal privacy and her personal rights ripped from her for 13 years now, it's horrible. And I don't understand how it could go on for so long. But, you know, we've seen all kinds of bizarre tragedies happen with celebrities, from Michael Jackson all the way down to, you can pick, I don't care who you want to pick, but certainly that's one that stands out. And the topper for me was this idea that she has an IUD in her body that she was decrying in court yesterday, and that we should even know that. It's such a private matter, the fact of how any woman chooses to pursue or not pursue motherhood or birth control or your sex life. It's none of our damn business. But the idea that A, that gets said in court, and B, that she is not able to have agency over that part of her life, I find so offensive. I cannot even find the words to speak how angry it makes me. That's my wax off.
All right, that'll do it for this week's Wax On, Wax Off. When we come back, we have Sharon's interview with Mayor of Easttown scene stealer Julianne Nicholson and my interview with In Treatment star Uzo Aduba. Stick around.
In the HBO Limited series, Mayor of Easttown, Julianne Nicholson plays Lori Ross, the best friend of Mayor Sheehan, who's the small town Pennsylvania detective who's investigating a series of murders of young women. In the series, Lori starts out as a background character, but as the series unfolds in one gripping episode after another, she becomes more and more central as a mother, a wife, and a friend. Her stunning performance in the final episode has led to a lot of online chatter about award season. If you haven't watched the show, just know there will be some spoilers in this interview. Let's see a clip and listen to a clip from the show.
Why didn't you come to me?
Laura.
No, just one thing. Why couldn't you just leave it alone? You have John. Why couldn't you just leave it alone? It's Ryan. It's Ryan. It's my Ryan. My Ryan. It was an accident. He doesn't even know how to hold a gun. Lauren. Why couldn't you just leave him alone? My whole family is gone now because of him.
Okay, so welcome, Julianne. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I think, you know, I speak for many when I say after we watched the final episode of the show, a lot of us just wanted to say like, wow, for starters, and wanted to talk to you about the performance. Certainly, that's how I felt. You've done so much great work, both in television and in film, over many years. This is really a standout performance of yours. Would you talk a little bit about how you got the role to start with and how you conceived of it as you were reading, you know, one script after another and watching the story unfold?
Sure. Thank you. I have known Kate for many years. My husband is best friends with her ex-husband. And so I've known her for as long as I've known my husband, which is about 18 years now. We live near each other in New York. My husband is her son's godfather. So we were pretty, we saw a lot of each other back then. I hadn't seen her in about 10 years, but she called me and said, I'm doing this show. It's about a detective in Philadelphia, but there's the part of her best friend and you have to do it. You must do it. It's amazing. And it's all about friendship. And I was like, well, of course she seems to have a pretty good picker when it comes to roles and projects to be a part of. So they sent me the first six episodes and I read them and I thought the series was amazing. And reading the first six, I didn't know if I should do it or not, because, you know, as you mentioned, Laurie starts off in the background and becomes more important to the overall story, but she doesn't do a lot in one to six. So it's like, okay. And they told me that, you know, there's going to be this big ending in seven and it ends with this friendship. And even filming it, quite honestly, I did not expect the payoff and the reaction to it to be as big as it seems to have become. Haven't watched the series, so I haven't.
You haven't watched the series?
I know. Shame on me. I can't.
At all? None of them?
I watched one scene, which is Evan Peters drunk at the bar when he's chatting her up at the bar, and he blew me away. I thought he was.
But you're not in that scene.
No, why? I don't want to watch myself.
Is this like a thing that you don't watch yourself?
You know, the more that I work, the older I get, the more I do, I just find like ultimately it does not serve me to watch the finished product. Some, if there's enough distance between me and the character, or some I feel comfortable watching, and others I just feel like I don't think that's a good idea. So it's kind of just like a gut thing.
Is it, and it's not a good idea because it doesn't make you feel good? It doesn't.
Yeah. Because you have ideas about what the experience was and what it felt like, and it often doesn't match or meet what you see.
But sometimes it exceeds it, doesn't it?
Yeah, but I want this one to live in my imagination and in my experience.
I can kind of understand that, like, even in my own writing, I don't like to go back and read my own stuff, but just, I don't know if they're quite analogous, but I sometimes find when I go back and read something really old, like, it's actually better. You're like, I'm sure it's terrible. Yeah. It turns out it's better than you think.
Maybe I'll watch in like 5 years.
Yeah.
I feel like then it'll feel better. Yeah. But I'm so glad in hindsight, and I was talking to Brad, the writer, the other day, the reason why
Brad Inglesby.
Yes. The reason, mm-hmm. thank you. The mm-hmm. reason why we can have the payoff with Lori, I think in episode 7, is because it's so unexpected. I think because she's sort of that constant solid throughout and the presence, but I think much of the impact comes from the surprise of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's also, I was watching, I like actually that HBO had decided that it has this policy where it doesn't drop the whole thing, that it makes you wait from week to week. And there's that anticipation.
Yeah.
And so everybody I knew was waiting for the finale, yeah. and everybody was online screaming about you and Kate and Jean Smart. I don't know if you saw that. I don't know if you go online at all.
I don't, but people have sent me, I've read some things and they've all been nice, really nice.
Yeah. So for those who haven't yet seen the series, first of all, go watch the series and stop watching this interview right now, because we don't want to ruin it for you. Because as Julian has alluded, there is a big payoff in episode 7. So basically, when you took the role that Kate said you really should do, this it'd be a great role for you, and you get, and you don't get to read the big payoff episode, you're just kind of going on faith, like, okay, they said it's going to be a big reveal, so I'm going to just take the leap.
That's how it happened. That's exactly how it happened. It also felt like, it was never going to be a bad idea, because it's still with Kate, it's still with Brad Inglesby, it's still with HBO. So it felt like, and then with, them saying that 7, I trusted Kate also that there would be enough in 7 to make it worth it. And I 100% am happy with the decision I made.
Yeah, of course.
Yes.
So basically you're there as kind of like, you have this very steely exterior as your character. Well, you can disagree if you like, but that's sort of how it strikes me. There's not a lot of emotion coming off of you. And you're this incredible mom who has, by the way, you're the actor who plays your son really looks exactly like you.
Cameron, I know when I met him, I was like, oh yeah, I get this casting. He could definitely be my kid.
He's got the freckles. He's got the
light eyes. He's from Connecticut. Yeah. I'm from Massachusetts. It's like, also, he's such a sweet kid too. He's such a nice guy. We hit it off.
I did check the credits to see if he was actually one of your kids, because I thought he looked so much like you. Yeah. And then you also have, of course, a Down syndrome daughter. So you're like this amazing mom, and you're dealing with all of these complications and not enough money and working folks and all of the dysfunction that's going on in your friends group. That's Kate and all the other people. I guess you guys were basketball players together in high school, I guess. So it's so rich and evocative, but your performance is very contained. Did you make that decision with the director or with Kate or just for yourself, and then kind of pace it through?
No, we didn't talk about what Lori's demeanor was. It just felt like to me, this person, she doesn't, because I don't know if it was in reaction to Mare or, but she just always felt solid to me. There's not a lot of fanfare. There's joy in the day to day when you find it, but it's also not an easy life. And that to me, and women I know from where I'm from outside of Boston, it's like, pull up your bootstraps or whatever that expression is, and like you get on with it. Mm-hmm. And so that felt like an honest portrayal of her circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you know women like that, or you grew up around and knew women like that from your past?
I mean, obviously these are extreme examples and sort of dark, but yeah, I think there's something that sort of the Northeast puts in people too, like hard winters, and just does something. There's like a humor, a close knit, and strength of character that comes with being from that part of the world, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you definitely feel that. So then let's talk a bit about this last episode in which we do find out that you've been lying to your best friend, Mare, for weeks about what you really know about who killed this other young woman in the community. And even now it feels like these are people I know. It feels very, it's so well done.
Someone sent me an Instagram post on Sunday night, a friend of mine, where someone had just written, I wonder what Mare's doing tonight on Sunday night.
Exactly.
People are feeling like the loss of that now. It's very sweet.
Completely. Yes. I hope that HBO was listening and will consider finding a reason to do another season. But in any event, yes. Yeah, so we're learning that you have been covering up for your son, and that is the big spoiler, and that then everything comes into focus for the viewer because you understand why you would do all of these things that would be out of character, that you would lie to your best friend, that you would accept your husband's philandering, that you would just be the stoic and do everything you can to just make all the bad things go away for your son. Can you talk a little bit about those? There's a couple of scenes in which your son comes running home from school, and then Kate, as Mare, comes in a subsequent scene and confronts you finally.
Yeah.
How was that to shoot?
So the scene in particular where Ryan comes home, I literally can only now talk about it without getting like upset. Cause I mean, just listening to you describe her circumstances, it's so awful. I just thought that was such a great scene. And, you know, I have a son that's about Cameron's age. Mm-hmm. And so I had an innate understanding of how, luckily, I have also a wonderful relationship with my son, as Lori and Ryan do. And it's this thing of where, like, their bodies are growing, but they're still boys, they're still children.
Yes.
So there's this interesting dynamic where you like balancing those two things. And, you know, as written, I think actually it had them, Lori and Ryan, they lie on the couch and she holds him on the couch. Mm. And it's felt, and Brad Inglesby is an amazing writer and has enough confidence and faith in all that he's written that he's also completely unprecious about his writing. So he's like, if that doesn't feel right, whether it be stage direction or change it, just tell me. Like, so I had this idea, like, my son still sits on my lap. Like, his feet are firmly on the floor when he sits on my lap and he's like, you know, six. But I said to Brad and to Craig Zobel, the director, I was like, first I asked Jill, Cameron's mother, I said, does Cameron still sit on your lap? And she's like, oh yeah. And I was like, you don't see that very often. Just like, you know, preteen boys on their mom's lap. And so I asked Cameron, I said, would you be comfortable if we did this? Like, you sit on my lap? And he's like, yeah. He said, sure. And so we asked Craig and Brad, and they said, yeah, great, let's try it. And it actually wound up working great for the shot to be able to see out the window. And that just felt like, that was just heartbreaking. Like listening to his voice and just the idea of, she knows, we thought we got away with it. It's just awful.
Yes. Yes.
But it felt very full and rich there on the day, and everything felt pretty present to draw from on in that scene. And then later with Mare, same thing. It felt like, knowing that we had the scene in the car where you think maybe that's it for them, it felt like a great relief to be able to have this, come back together.
So in the car, you tell her, you push her away and you say, basically, I don't want to talk to you anymore. There's nothing I have to say to you.
Yeah.
And then Mare comes to your house sort of uninvited and walks in uninvited and approaches you from behind, and you collapse in her arms And it's such a beautiful moment. Did you rehearse that? Did you
talk it through? We didn't talk through, from what I remember, we didn't talk through much about it because we all knew it was all on the page. You know, Brad wrote that she comes over, she touches her, she turns around. And I think that's also brave of a writer to trust the silences, to know that what you've created have brought us all to this place, and it can happen without words sometimes. Sometimes even more powerful, I think, without words, if you're, if you can.
Yes.
And so I don't think we did it too many times. I said to someone else, and it's true, I was really scared about the falling to the floor because I felt like, how do you do that? You know what I mean? Like, how do you do that in any sort of believable way? Because it just felt like I understood the intention and the feeling of that, but how do you do that in a way that just doesn't feel dramatic or overly dramatic? But I think we probably marked it out just like to go through the motions, the beats for the camera, but didn't rehearse in any sort of emotional way. And then we just started filming, and then it felt actually incredibly authentic. And we just found that position where it just sort of naturally turned into that thing on the floor where she's holding Lori.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's very. I kept thinking of the Pietà.
Yeah, I know. I do too. I've seen some stills of it because, as I said, I'm not really going online, but people will send me things. Not a lot, but like, you know, a couple of people have sent me things, and I've seen a picture of us on the floor. It does look like that. Her laid out. It's a beautiful image, I think, just visually.
Yeah. Yeah. What was the conversation between you and Kate, or was there just no conversation? Like, you don't need to prepare. It's just
I don't think we had to prepare. I think we were there. I think with the history that we have, just knowing each other for as long as we have, and in the way, it's not been a regular presence in each other's life, but it still was a constant, and always like no time had passed when we had seen each other. So I think I've watched her movies. Like, she's one of the greatest actresses ever. Like, before I met her, I just thought she's just remarkable. And so I think we trusted each other and like have a love for each other there already. And so we didn't have to like go through what was happening.
Mm-hmm. I do think her performance is also one of the standouts of her career in this series. How do you get that accent totally solid while you're also playing somebody so far from your experience?
I know.
You know,
she's remarkable, and I'm so happy for her because she also executive produced this show. So she threw herself like 150% into every aspect of this show, not just the acting. And so to have, you know, to be a part of something that touches people so deeply, it's like what you're hoping for. And it's so rare that that actually happens. So it's a thrill for me to be a part of it, but also as a friend to just, you know, just champion your friend and be so happy that all her in work paid off. It's great.
Yeah. So when you see that there are people saying, can we get another season? And Kate gave an interview in which she said, yeah, I would love to play it again. Sort of like, how does that resonate with you?
I mean, I love that idea. I think the thing is always, you know, finding it's so hard to like repeat something. And I think that if Brad found a way that felt good to him, then I would trust that.
Wonderful. Yeah, okay, so you're in, Kate's in.
Yeah, we're in. Maren, that's Maren Lori. It's on.
Exactly.
We're the press.
We are the press, so yeah, right. That's cool. Okay, good. So we will get to HBO and just say, you know, there's a groundswell.
Yeah.
cast is in.
There's three people on board.
Three people on board. Exactly. And, you know, my vote counts.
What else?
Exactly. I want to ask you also, I understand you're in an upcoming project, also on HBO, about the Lakers.
Uh-huh. Yeah, they're doing Lakers based on the book Showtime, basically about the year that when, like 1979, when Jerry Buss bought the Lakers, and it's Magic Johnson's first season, and the history around that. Yeah.
And what do you play in that?
I play Cranny McKinney, who is Jack McKinney's wife. Jack McKinney, played by Tracy Letts, is who was hired as a coach for the Lakers that season, and then things happen to him that make it not possible. So I'm there supporting Jack.
That sounds really fun. Is that done?
Am I gonna dunk?
No. Is the shooting done?
Dunking all over the place. He has like free throw contests with Magic. It's amazing. No, we're very much in the early days. And it's like, it's a beast. It's beautiful and flashy and so many characters and so colorful. And it's also a true story. So it's like matching the time period, matching the look. And it's an incredible cast. So it's not over. I think we're right sort of finishing up episode 4, and there are 10 episodes in total.
Oh, wow. So you're in the thick of it. Okay. Very cool. Well, we have something else to look forward to instead of just watching Mare of Easttown again. And then of course, lobbying HBO. Well, Julianne Nicholson, thank you so much. Yeah, I got a lot to do on your behalf. But thank you so much for joining us here on the podcast.
My pleasure.
And thank you for your incredible performance and for your body of work over the years, which we've all loved. But just wanted to especially thank you for playing Laurie Ross and bringing her to life. She's very beautiful and I think will endure for a long time.
So
yeah. Thanks for coming.
My pleasure.
All right, you know our next guest from her work on Orange is the New Black, for which she won 2 Emmy Awards, and from her role as Shirley Chisholm in last year's limited series Mrs. America, for which she won another Emmy Award. And she can now be seen as Dr. Brooke Taylor in the HBO series In Treatment, for which I predict, and I don't think I'm going out on a limb here, she's going to receive another Emmy nomination. Please welcome to the wrap-up, Uzo Aduba.
Hi.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm sure, I feel like every interview starts with, did you watch the original In Treatment? But I am such a huge fan of the original In Treatment. I legitimately want to know, were you a fan of the first show? The original, the first few seasons?
I did not watch it when it was out originally. I have to be honest.
Okay, all right.
I know. I did not.
Did you go back and watch any of it?
Not while I was filming, because then when, you know, they asked, you know, would I do the show? I shouldn't say I didn't watch any of it. I watched a little bit of the first episode. Most of the first episode, actually, in the end, just to get the sense of the format, you know, because when I was reading it, I was like, surely they don't really mean 2 people just sitting here like talking.
Oh, no.
And then I was like, oh no, they do mean that. That's exactly what they mean. So I watched the first episode, but since now we finished, I have started.
And I like it. How far in are you?
Season 1, I think I'm on 6
episodes. Week 6 or like 6 episodes? All right, I need you to do me a
6
favor.
Episodes in, 6 episodes. You said what?
Okay, you have a lot. You have a lot to go. It's a long
season. I know, because
the
first season was also like, the first season has like 40
like 50
or something.
Yeah, there's a lot.
Yeah, like, yeah, there's a...
Okay, you need to do me a favor. You need to make sure you get through the first season, because you've met Alex, right? Blair mm-hmm. Underwood's character. He talks about his dad a lot. And eventually his dad shows up, and it's the best episode of anything I've ever seen. Glenn Turman plays his father.
Okay. Is that, I know he's in it, but I didn't.
Yes.
Okay.
He won the Emmy for guest role for that one episode. It's 30 minutes, one episode. And it's the best performance of anything I've ever seen in my entire life. And it is, even if you get like a little stalled, watch the Alex episodes and get to his, because he talks about his father throughout and he builds him up to be this thing.
And then Glyd Turman walks in, and he is he was the embodiment of everything Blair Underwood talked about.
Oh, I can't.
It is.
And I love Glyd Turman already. Oh, he's, a beast. He's amazing of an actor. And he was amazing. Great in Fargo. He was incredible in Fargo.
Yes,
he was Dr. Senator character. He was incredible in Fargo. I love him. I think he's exceptional. I love him.
So is worth it just to get to that episode, please. I know I can't make you do it, but
yeah. Just but try. You might implore. Yeah.
So if you hadn't seen the show originally, what about it drew you to do this role?
Okay. So the things that drew me to doing the role. The first thing was the nagging question. Well, actually, the first thing was getting to sit in the seat of a therapist. I was like, this is probably the only opportunity in my life that I'll get to like sit in the occupied.
You're not chair. On the couch, you're in the chair.
I'm in the chair, exactly. And so that was interesting to me. Then when I was reading the scripts, well, actually, when I was talking to Josh and Jen, Joshua Allen and Jen, who are the showrunner for this season, I'm trying to figure out like chicken and the egg of it, but I think it was talking with them about what the, you know, skeleton of the show was going to be. And I could understand, some of the parts of the character and the world and life that she was moving through. So then that led me to really want to answer the question, why do people go to therapy? I just kept hearing that question in my head play out. Why do people go to therapy? And it was interesting to me to be watching a character, Brooke Taylor, Dr. Brooke Taylor, we're meeting all of her patients after the decision has been made because they're already in session. So we're not actually seeing that question itself play out. We're seeing them, they've already arrived at the choice of going. And then I thought it was interesting to be watching her character navigate this chapter of her life. And she hasn't yet arrived at the decision of seeking treatment, whatever that might be. And so that became interesting.
Yeah, it's an interesting twist on the narrative of the first iteration of the show, because she's not, at the start at least, in therapy. Her episodes are her talking to her sponsor, which I thought was a nice sort of twist on it. And that relationship is very similar, mm-hmm. I think. You know, for me, this show, when I heard it was coming back, I was excited because, like I said, I was such a huge fan of the original. And I think one of the things that makes the timing of it so interesting is that, you know, in this last year or so, I feel like the conversation about mental health has changed so much.
For sure.
How do you feel the show fits in with that discussion?
I think it does fit into the discussion. I think for number one, there's the obvious. When the show came out originally, we were not living in a pandemic, you know, so like there's that one, you know, and so there hasn't ever been a time where we as a global family can all uniformly cite an event, a major event as a globe that has occurred in our lives that has affected us in some way or another. And so I think this is timely in that way because everyone is in process of what that looked like for them, still looks like for them, felt like, all of it, you know? And then I think another piece that's major highlight is the difference between in treatment 1.0 and 2.0 is the conversations that are happening about mental health. You know, that show, and I think it's wickedly brave of HBO to have been putting on a show of that type definitely a stigma surrounded mental health, sure, in that conversation. So it's not like people are having open discussions about mental health when the show originally premiered. But I think it's really interesting to be on a show now when people are actually re-examining the conversation of mental health and what that looks like, and especially in a time when the range of what that means has expanded beyond the really narrow way we used to have that conversation.
Yeah, and I think you guys, you know, the pandemic is part of the show, but only a little. You know, it just, there's references here and there, and obviously the Anthony Ramos scenes are you know, telehealth, I think, has become a big thing. I want to ask you a little bit about the production behind some of that stuff. I'm mostly just curious, with the Anthony Ramos scenes, were you guys actually on a Zoom together? Were you actually talking to him, or how did you film those scenes?
Yeah, no, we were really for real Zooming. Like, it wasn't actually Zoom, but you know, right. like whatever form of Zoom they created. But yeah, we were on those, and they built a stage. Like, it's like me sitting here in the Brooke house, you know, on the stage, and then just off would be the room, was the room that they built for Eladio's room, Anthony's character. And he was in there, and yeah, they'd call action and like actually sign on to the computer and shoot it. And there were cameras obviously in the room with us, but all of that, I haven't watched yet, but all of, if they, whatever camera footage you see, that was live, real.
And how is it doing those scenes versus, you know, doing Owens or Layla's or any of the other ones?
It was interesting, you know. It was the first time I'd ever obviously acted virtually with anybody. So that was interesting. But I honestly think it did feel the same. Like, there are subtleties that you miss in the beginning, because just breath, energy, subtle, you can't see what I'm doing with my hands right now. Do you know what I'm saying? So whatever that story looks like below the frame, I'm not capturing necessarily, nor is he mine. So it was really, really exciting and satisfying, not to spoil, when there is another moment for our characters to experience one another. But I have to say, I think it would have felt different if we didn't already have the shorthand for communication over Zoom that pandemic taught us. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, like, yeah, sure.
If it was April 1st, 2020 that we were shooting this, I think is a very different experience than months of Zooming with people, where we have now familiarized ourselves with this form of communication.
Yeah, I do a lot of these, and you can tell in the beginning, people were like set up wherever, and you talk to people a few months later, they've got like lighting and
yeah,
and they've set up a shot. Earlier, by the way, I misspoke. I called Owen's character, it's Colin. I said Owen. Mm-hmm, that's mm-hmm. my mistake. I was misremembering a few. It's interesting when you do watch it, the first, I don't know, like half of the Eladio first episode, the camera is only in the room with you and shows him on screen. And I kind of was wondering if we would never be in the room with Eladio, but eventually we do in that first episode get there. I just thought that was interesting as a way to, we're experiencing Eladio the way you are in that scene mm-hmm. where you're mm-hmm. not there, present for most of it. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the stage where you shot. I'm disappointed to know that's not a real house, because I want to live there.
That house is gorgeous.
But I feel like, and I want to talk about this in another way in a minute, but like the set and the costuming is a character almost in the show. How do you feel like it represented Brooke to the audience? Because I think it had a very specific purpose.
Oh, 100%. I think the same. You know, I think keeping in mind that we're living still, you know, in these COVID times, right? It was so deliberate, it felt like, to me anyway, the way that Brooke chooses to present, you know, it to herself, to the world. You look at the costuming done by Tiffany Hasborn and the production design by Catherine. Like, these were things that she set, they were so meticulous and deliberate, and never a hair out of place, never a shirt not well pressed, any of it, you know, all of it is perfectly laced. And I think that speaks to Brooke's never wanting to seem affected in any way. That speaks to her upbringing and the life experience that was placed, you know, what was placed on her by her father, who was also extremely meticulous. It's a reflection of that level of excellence that she felt was expected of her. It's a reflection of the broader Black excellence that is, you know, a term we're all now familiar with, you know. And I think, but I really do think of it as more than anything, her protection, you know, especially in a time when we're living in a COVID time where everybody is in sweatpants and t-shirts. Nobody is dressing up. Everybody is like, everyone has laid down, like, the, you know what I mean? Like, everybody has laid down the pretend, the curtain is up, the jig is up. We're all like in our pajamas. You know what I mean? So like, the fact that she wakes up every morning to put her nails on, to get her, you know, do her hair, to do her makeup, to wear those clothes every single time, you realize at some point this is not her passion, this is her protection. And that no hair is out of place, the house is pristine. I thought it was absolutely stunning to look at this perfect placement in this world of a woman who is entirely fragile and broken right now.
Yeah, I think she was also real. I think there's a concern for me when I was watching it, I was like, okay, therapist, and she has her own problems and they're gonna be super exaggerated, but everything felt very real for her, mm-hmm. what she was going through. It never felt super exaggerated. I have a couple of random metaphors I wanna throw at you about the show. Cause like I said, I love the show. I think about it a lot. Do you watch cooking shows, or do you cook yourself a lot?
I do cook. I do not watch a lot of cooking shows.
I do not cook very well, but I do enjoy watching cooking shows. I learn a lot from them. And one of the techniques that I've learned, you know, especially in competitions where they have a lot of time constraint, is they vacuum seal like a mm-hmm. steak or a chicken or something to get mm-hmm. a lot of flavor in.
Yes.
In a short amount of time. They're like, I got to get, you know, In Treatment feels like a vacuum sealed television show because you guys just suck in so much in such a short amount of time. Did you feel that as you were shooting it, that you had this like hyper sense of like, I can't believe how much we do in 25 minutes each week?
Oh, for sure. For sure. Absolutely. It felt longer than that, to be honest with you. There was so, but you realize it's like, because you don't have that like random driving scene, you know what I mean?
Yeah, there's no exposition. There's no B-side.
Exactly, that there's a lot of room in particular for the writers to play and create space and story for those characters in ways that maybe we don't traditionally get to see in other shows, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, it's very strange that even though I could probably enjoy this entire show by listening, I find that because it's shorter, it's the one show that like, I don't check Twitter. I'm not watching a NBA game in the side to check the score. Like, because I feel like everything is intentional. Every movement, every look carries more weight because it's in this shorter time period. And I think it's really interesting.
Absolutely. Well, and also like you remember it's like this, something I learned in the playing of this show, at least, it's like every word and every action of the patient matters and is important to the therapist, because you don't know their life other than the life they bring into that room. And because I think also like patients, it seems, have a sensitivity to the fact that they're actually being heard, but they also are like somewhere aware that they're being observed. So there's this like, it's really interesting to watch like those first few sessions, everybody's trying to like feel each other out. So you are really checking to make sure what you're clocking is what you're clocking. And then it becomes fascinating to watch people uncover and reveal themselves over time more and more. And you wonder how much of what I saw was actually connected to what actually is.
Yeah, I think especially the Colin episodes, definitely there was a lot of feeling out between the two characters. He was definitely throwing some things at you to see how you would react and treat. There was a lot of feeling out there. Mm. All right, metaphor number two. Are you a sports fan?
Yes.
Okay, basketball?
Yes.
Who's your team?
College,
by the way?
In particular. College, oh. I prefer college to pro. But if I'm doing pro, Celtics.
Celtics, okay. Who's your college team?
Kentucky.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Wildcats.
Yeah, it's very successful. I grew up a big Tar Heel fan, so.
Oh, okay.
Even though I'm from New York City. But my mom raised me. And
are you a Knicks basketball fan?
No, I am not. I'm confused. it's not to get off on a sidetrack. I grew up a Laker fan, even because my mom, again,
in New York,
my mom was a Laker fan. My mom was a Tar Heel fan. That's how she raised me. And over the years, I've discovered there are too many great players for me to root for any one team anymore. Like, how do you root against Kevin Durant? I cannot do it. Damian Lillard, like, so I just root for players. I root for greatness. I enjoy watching everything. Mm. All right, we got off track.
Like,
but my metaphor for this is, I think you are in this role, the point guard, in that sometimes you have to take control and score, mm-hmm. but you also in this role are the setup person. Mm-hmm. There are so many episodes where you are in some ways not the focal point at all, but you have to elevate the person you're with. You know, I'm thinking particularly of Layla's monologue in the third episode, where she talks about, you know, the fear of being a Black woman in this world. Mm-hmm. But you have to sort of support her in those scenes. I'm wondering in those moments how you approach those scenes where you are really there to boost someone else and their performance.
Oh, as an actor, what am I?
Yeah.
Just
how you approach those particular scenes where you're like, all right, I know this is their time. I have to be there for them.
Yeah,
it happens a lot.
I think it's the same way. Well, firstly, I think it's like super, super like rudimentary basics, like active listening. And that is also partly the role of a therapist, that it's like, I couldn't listen like this, even if I was a great listener like that. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like, even that was my best listening space, because it's like, that is not going to signal to the person who actually needs support, meaning not support in their work, meaning like to feel heard. That is not productive, right? So I think my main job was kind of borrowing a little bit of a page out of Dr. Brooke Taylor's book, and saying, what does my castmate need from me right now? And how can I be there for them right now? Even if it's different from what maybe I would do in my own coverage. Do you know what I mean? Because it's like, it's a lot. These guys were incredible in what they were doing. Every single one of them, they were amazing to me. You know, their versatility, their ability to change performance in a drop of a hat, 10 pages to prepare what is and be performance ready for something that is quite a heavy lift, you know? And my desire was for that to be a win every take, you know, every single take, which is a lot of material. And so my goal and my wish and my want was just to be open to hearing all that they were saying, all that they were doing. And I think that's true for the character. So it didn't feel out of line for who Brooke is. You know, Brooke is there to make sure that her patients feel heard and meet them where they are in the best way possible to help get them to a closer truth about themselves.
Yeah, I think you know, there's times where you comment, there's times where you ask a question, there's times where you lean back or lean in or just sort of turn your, like every little, those little moments, they elevate the entire scene, I think, in a way that's really interesting to look at. I wanted to ask you, I usually don't do plot specific questions, but I was watching one of the episodes catching up because I haven't watched them all yet. It's
no worries.
I'm savoring them. And also, like, it's a heavy show. It's hard to do. I'd do like four or five in a day.
Yeah.
And you Brooke's character in one episode talks about she has a superpower, right? Her helping people is, you know, her and Eladio were talking about this particular thing. And she said, and Brooke says to Eladio, "You have the superpower of helping people." He says it back. In the episode where Rita has discovered that your character is drinking again, mm-hmm. and you guys are discussing the nature of your relationship as sponsor and sponsee, mm-hmm. and she says to you that basically, you know, what it's telling you, what the rules are telling her at this particular point in time, is that she needs to step away from you, right? You've sort of, you know, the rules of the sponsor have said, I should do this, I should do this, I should do this. If you don't respond, I detach. And I feel like Brooke in that moment uses her superpower for evil and manipulates Rita to be, I haven't gone past that episode yet, but she basically just turns on her therapist mode to manipulate Rita to go against everything she's been taught to do. Is that how it struck you? Because I talked to my boss this morning about it and she was like, I don't know if I think of it that way. And I was like, oh, it jumped out at me.
No, I think so. I don't think she meant to do it, but it is what, for me, I thought was interesting about where we meet her, Brooke, because I don't think she only does, she uses her superpowers in more than once in ways that,
okay, I'll look out for that,
you know, to me are what serve as the difference between Professor X and Magneto. You know, like, that's the dividing line, you know, between the two of those characters. So yeah, I don't think she thought that was what she was doing, but that at the end of the day is what she did.
I agree. I felt a little, you know, I'll be curious to see how the rest of the season goes for her. Cause like I said, I'm at the middle of four, but that was a unique scene, I thought. And it left me with it was amazing, obviously, but it left me a little bit with a bad taste in my mouth for Brooke, where I was like, okay.
Well, she's not infallible. I learned something there.
No.
Absolutely.
In a believable way. It was a very believable, like I said, this isn't the show where you're not Tony Soprano, you're not Vic Mackey. This isn't like an anti-hero kind of show. It's just a real person who's responding in a real way.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I think it was also what I thought Joshua and Jen did so honestly there was highlight some of the less than lovely aspects of addiction, even if it's coming to you packaged in a functional way. You know, she is someone who she's hiding things, right? Like she hides and has that ability to, and one of those things that we get to see is her alcohol addiction, you know, and who were meeting her at a time where she might not have made those choices in another year in that relationship with Rita. But because where we're meeting her is we're meeting her in a moment when she is not sober, right? Or is wrestling with her sobriety. We're seeing her make the choices that kind of got her in a tough spot. We're seeing how some of those choices don't lead to positive ends.
For sure. Yeah, it's a great character. It's a great part. I love the show so much. I can't wait to continue and finish it up. And I can't wait for you to finish the first season. I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I'm going to follow up with you and make sure. You will love it. I feel so confident. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time. I it was a total joy. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me too, Daniel.
And that's it for this week's episode of The Wrap-Up. Thank you to all of our listeners, and remember to please follow or subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcast. Be sure to rate and review us and let us know what you think of the pod. See you next time.